That's Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's time to check in with Andy Downs, who's the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, to check in on the General Assembly session, how it's coming along, and a number of yet finished issues that have come up, and some of them have picked up quite a bit of controversy. And Andy, thank you for joining us on the program today.
It's always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, sometimes it's fun to keep an eye on the lawmakers. Sometimes they do some interesting things, and I guess right now is one of those times, especially with the latest questions that are still lingering out there concerning about whether a hate crimes bill will pass this General Assembly session in the form that it's in, whether it's going to get changed back into its previous form. And now, too, there's turned out to be something else, too. Just a simple thing as a driver's license or a state-issued ID card has kind of gotten into the mix of things. Tell us where things stand as far as you know.
You know, there are certain bills that get introduced that we can just about guarantee are going to end up in a conference committee. And to remind people, conference committee is when a bill passes both chambers, but it doesn't match when it comes out of both chambers. So members of both chambers get together to see if they can work out the differences. I think it's safe to say that the hate crimes legislation was going to be one of those things. The question really was, which version of the hate crimes legislation was going to be the one that sort of got the attention. And at this point, it looks like it was the Senate bill, or is the Senate bill, I guess is the better way to put that. We'll have to wait and see what happens. That will make it into conference committee. Obviously, what they're debating is whether or not we should have a list of folks or a list of categories, or whether you simply should be able to enhance sentence because of bias, regardless of whether or not the person against whom the bias existed was in a particular category or not. So that's certainly one that will get hashed out sort of behind the scenes, so to speak. We knew that was going to be the case from the beginning, though. I think another thing that's worth mentioning very quickly, though, is the session has to end by midnight on April 29th, but more importantly, April 15th and April 16th are really big days, because those are the days by which a bill either has to make it out of the Senate or out of the House. The 15th for making it for a Senate bill making it out of the House, 16th for a House bill making it out of the Senate. Things that don't make it out by then theoretically are dead and gone for this session. But every now and then, magical things do happen in those conference committees.
And you think that this might be one of those? Could possibly?
I'm fairly certain that something's going to end up in conference committee.
Yep.
The question is what will happen after it gets there. Things that make it to conference committee don't always make it to passage, and that may be what happens here. The House may say, okay, we're going to pass something, let it go to conference committee, let it be fought out there, and if they can't come to an agreement, so be it. I'm not a betting person, but I think there are probably plenty of people who would bet that this is not going to pass. Will end in conference committee, but not pass.
I know one of the things that came up here within even the last week and a half or so was this issue about the driver's license gender being whether it's M, F, or X, depending on how you choose. I guess the Bureau of Motor Vehicles introduced that information based on what they felt was wise guidance by the overall, policy agency, the national one that deals with bureaus of motor vehicles. But now it turns out, too, that the members of the legislature had to have their say-so in the two. Where do you think things are standing right now in that?
You know, things evolve over time, obviously, and we certainly see more and more folks who are interested or express an interest in gender reassignment, and it's a reality that we basically have to deal with one way or another. The bill in question here is known as Senate Bill 182, and I think this is probably controversial enough that we may not end up with an answer right now. This may be one of those times when the legislature says this is something that we need to study more carefully instead of making a knee-jerk decision. So this is one of those things could end up being the subject of an interim study committee that gets looked at a little more carefully over the summer.
Now, where do things stand as far as what the BMV has to do? Are they still allowing it? Or we know that the bill basically brings up whether you have to have a certified amended birth certificate, especially for a gender change. That has to be submitted to the BMV rather than just signing off on a form. Are they going to basically hold off on this, as far as you can tell, until the study committee comes up with what kind of guidance the BMV should take?
My understanding at this point is that the BMV has simply added a third gender option.
Right.
And so the legislature is the body that's now saying, okay, what do we really want to count as gender on our driver's license? And we should keep in mind that from an academic standpoint, sex is the thing that's about the biological features. Gender is basically something that we've constructed over time as masculine and feminine. And if it's truly a construct, then theoretically people should be able to make a choice of their own. If the indication on the driver's license is strictly about biology, well, then that's a different discussion to have. And the subtleties of the issue, I think, are the reason that it may end up in a conference committee, or excuse me, in an interim study committee. But like I said, my understanding at this point is the BMV has added a third category or third gender option, and lawmakers want to have their say on that.
I know one of the other measures that has gone through the legislature so far, it's been revised in the Indiana House, is a Senate bill that would deal with, and this comes up in your area, Northeast Indiana, about some problems and some tragic issues that led the bill to be filed that would allow school districts across the state to be able to buy cameras that can be installed on school bus stop arms to be able to catch motorists who try to illegally pass the school bus. Where do things stand, and do you think that's going to be one of these measures that will get pushed all the way through?
There actually are a number of places in bills where you can find information about efforts to enhance the safety of schools generally or more specifically. I think it is safe to say that, A, there will be additional funding for school safety. The larger question for me is whether or not the General Assembly is going to allow for referenda regarding school safety. So in other words, a school district could say, we want to increase your taxes outside of the levy, outside of the cap, excuse me, in order to pay for additional safety, whether that's, you know, doors on the buildings, those sorts of things. That's one that a lot of people have focused on as well. But it's safe to say there will be additional money for safety. The question is, will there be extra money, so to speak, outside of the tax caps? And if so, how can it be used?
I know that, of course, such things are allowed in public referenda for improvements and the like, and for being able to increase over the tax base to be, at least for now, to be able to take care of operational costs. Would that be something they'd have to kind of amend the procedure to be able to do if they decide to do so?
Yeah, my understanding is it creates basically a third category.
Yeah.
So you have the operations referendum, you have capital expense referenda, and then you have safety capital expense referenda. So that's my understanding last time I saw or chatted with anyone about that bill.
One of the other bills that we know that has come up here, and I don't know if you've seen the latest on that, and it may be just kind of waiting along or kind of sitting on hold, is concern. And a lot of it, I know, in this case in particular, is tied with the two-year state budget, is dealing with public transportation in Indiana. There's a lot of concern, I know, certainly from the supporters of passenger rail, that there may not be any money in the budget for the next 2 years to be able to handle services like Amtrak, and maybe even some other privately owned or publicly owned, rather, private transportation, too.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I have not been following that this session as carefully as I normally like to. I use the South Shore when I'm up on the northern part of the state. Obviously, there are a lot of people who are interested in being able to go from Indianapolis and parts between Indy and Chicago to Chicago without having to drive. But we are certainly a culture that drives our cars maybe more than a lot of other parts of the country. So I'm not sure where that's going to end up. I know that when people talk about public transportation, they're usually talking about a few things, whether that's allowing for additional sort of conventional public transportation, city buses, those sorts of things. It's a discussion about maintaining things like Amtrak or additional support for the South Shore. And then the third category would be sort of new things. Should we create new lines anywhere? And that third category is usually about money to study and do engineering work to figure out what's feasible and begin to get an idea of the total cost of doing something like the Red Line down in Indianapolis that's being done right now.
Yeah. One of the other points, too, I want to check on, and you may have updates if there are, of course, is what has come about lately with the, I guess it's, It's been called by some people, including Ed Feigenbaum, as the gaming omnibus bill, and it seems to be taking changes almost every week, I guess. What's the latest that you've seen on that?
Well, once again, that's one of those bills that I'm always certain is going to end up in conference committee. There's a lot of discussion about stuff. The short version is, of course, there will be one fewer option up in Northwest Indiana, and the likely place for that option is in Terre Haute. Those are the things that have come up, as far as I'm concerned, have come up most frequently. And I often think when it comes to gaming, the things that come up most frequently are the ones that are going to happen. It's just a question of, can they work out other details around it? But there really does seem to be an appetite for some gaming in Terre Haute and a little less gaming up your way.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that kind of goes with it, too, is in this case it's generating revenue, but we talk about, and we've mentioned here briefly about the two-year state budget. That's still going through the legislature there, too. And do we have this timeline that you mentioned about the deadline, I should say, in middle of April to assure things that each of the budget bills make it from one chamber into the other?
Well, we have had instances, and this may shock people, we've actually had instances when they've basically not gotten the budget done. This happened, I think the most recent version of this was during Governor Daniels' time in office, and when the session ended, there was no budget, and basically everybody got back together in a few weeks to pass a budget after they had agreed to things. This is I'm going to say, surprisingly contentious this year. There's a little more revenue than we had been seeing, so people were kind of optimistic about that. But we know that Division of Child Services needed an awful lot more revenue. People wanted to put more money into education, and they wanted to put more money into job training, let alone funding things like maybe a few more road projects and infrastructure projects. So even though there was more revenue, there's been some pretty heavy fighting over what to do with that revenue, even though there's agreement that all of those things deserve more money. We have not had a big blow-up this session like we often do, and that blow-up often serves as a reset button for everybody. We've not had that this time. I was talking with someone last week about whether or not we're going to see one, and they were thinking that we will not. Mm-hmm. Last year, remember, there was no reset. There was no big blow-up and reset, and they basically stumbled their way to the end. The fear is we may be looking at that again, and if that's the case, the budget is probably one of those things that will get tied up in it. Having said that, more often than not, by a really high percentage, they managed to pass the budget, and that, of course, really is something that's done among the highest levels of the caucuses getting together and work out the details, and then the backbenchers asked to basically vote along with it.
Well, Andy, thanks for your insight and comments on the measures that are making it through the 2019 General Assembly, and we'll check back with you very soon to see how things are coming along.
Hey, let me just throw one more bill in there for people to check out,
okay.
And that would be Senate Bill 613. This is the consumer credit bill that was introduced by Andy Zay and Mark Messmer. This is the one that theoretically is supposed to create kind of a middle ground between really, really high interest rates and conventional bankable loans. There's some question about whether it actually accomplishes that or not, so I think that's another one of those bills that people might want to take some good close look at and contact their legislators. Don't worry about telling them vote yes or vote no. I think it's more important to say to the legislators, I support the following concept, or I'm opposed to the following concept. That way they get a pretty clear idea of where you're standing, not just whether you think they should vote yes or no on a particular piece of legislation. I think that's one that a lot of people need to be keeping an eye on.
And that's aside from the lobbying up here in Northwest Indiana that is being sought by communities as well as Save the Dunes to make sure that the rules don't get changed for those people who live in houses and in places along Lake Michigan that will keep just the average vacationer or people that enjoy the beach from getting on the property.
Exactly.
That's another one, too. Yeah.
So much to watch.
This is one of those sessions, to be sure. Andy, thank you very much for talking about it today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Andy Downs is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. As counties across Indiana grapple with exploding jail population, some lawmakers are looking at ways to give them some relief. They've been proposing some changes that include directing more funds to counties and help in turn send some felons back to prisons. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier explains why some are worried that these These may just be temporary fixes to a larger incarceration crisis.
Danica Kennedy has been at the Hancock County Jail for nearly a month. She's housed in a cell block that's so full, several women are sleeping on bunk beds in the common area. The constant commotion makes it hard to stay focused. Even the smallest of problems can escalate into fights.
You have people who get upset because it's a line in the shower, it's razor day, and somebody jumps in front of them.
On this particular day, there are 211 people in a jail meant to house fewer than 160. That doesn't include the 70 inmates jail commander Keith Oliver says they're paying other counties to house.
Last year, we spent almost $600,000 sending other inmates to other counties.
The problem extends well beyond this jail. A 2018 report from the Indiana Criminal Justice Institute shows 77% of the state's jails were at or over capacity. Police and prosecutors across the state will tell you the reasons are multifaceted. They blame the opioid epidemic for an uptick in drug offenses and violent crime. And criminal code reform legislators passed a few years ago means level 6 felons are taking up valuable space in their facilities instead of serving their sentences in prison.
I believe that we, as a state of Indiana, changed the criminal code, have played a big part in the jail overcrowding, and I think we should resolve it.
That's Representative Randy Fry, who authored a bill to ease the burden criminal code reform placed on local jails. It would allow counties to request the Department of Correction take in convicted level 6 felons if their facility is at capacity. The DOC would house those inmates in regional holding facilities that it would open in buildings it already owns, like shuttered prisons.
Well, currently, there's no funding in the bill for additional revenue to DOC. So the way we fund it now is that the $35 a day per diem that the county gets when they have a prisoner is then transferred to Department of Corrections while they have the prisoner.
Research from the Vera Institute for Justice, a nonprofit that aims to reduce mass incarceration, points to a bigger problem. Jasmine Heiss is the director of outreach and public affairs for Vera's In Our Backyards initiative. She says Indiana is an outlier when it comes to its jail population.
We're in this moment that's often talked about as sort of the reversal of mass incarceration. Indiana, in many ways, has been moving or staying in the opposite direction.
Heiss says no other state has increased its jail population so dramatically in the past decade. Dozens of Indiana counties are considering building new jails as a result. In Hancock County, some residents expressed concerns during a recent public hearing about a proposed new jail. Oliver says they need the facility to comply with state and federal requirements.
To allow for staff to be more safe, to allow inmates to be safer in our facility, this is something we have to do.
Voters here rejected a request in May to fund the project through a property tax increase. So now the county council wants to raise local income taxes by 0.2%. Greenfield resident Matthew Kofer says he wants the leaders to consider other alternatives.
For instance, rehabilitation for people who are capable of being rehabilitated. Restitution to the victims of crime. Instead of just locking them up in the local jail, make them do something useful.
He questions whether building a new jail is the best solution in a place some jokingly call Handcuff County. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
There's a lot of talk in the news these days about civility and the like, and we're bringing it home to Northwest Indiana in particular with a number of events here. And one in particular will start out. The Gary Chamber of Commerce is sponsoring once again another World Civility Day. And to find out a little bit about the history of the topic, as well as what's coming up for this year's event, we have Chuck Hughes, the Executive Director of the Gary Chamber of Commerce, with us. Chuck, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, Chris, thank you for the opportunity.
Talk about the importance, certainly, from the Gary Chamber of Commerce's point of view of civility and what that kind of led into the creation of the World Civility Day.
Well, Chris, we were in my public policy committee meeting. We have various committees of the chamber, and they were looking for an initiative. And this is something that I had been thinking about for years. And I said to them, let's kind of look around and see what's going on in the world right now. I mean, you've got bullying, you've got road rage, you've got domestic situations, you've got people who are having discussions and the discourse is not civil. I said, you know what, public policy is a broad-ranging aspect of a business organization. Why don't we adopt a civility initiative? And so when I mentioned that to the chair, Dr. Gordon Bradshaw, and the other committee members, they loved the idea. So initially what we were going to do, and this, mind you, was 4 years ago, mm-hmm. this preceded much of what's the angst and the incivility that we're seeing occurring right now. So we were ahead of the curve in that regard. And so what we were going to do was have an initiative that we would try to share throughout our chamber membership so that maybe the meetings would be smoother and people would be able to have better relationships, which would translate into being able to handle transactions between them even better. And so it was going to be internal at first. So I decided to call Chris White at the Times, the publisher of the Times newspaper, because I said, well, you know, this is something that maybe we can share with other organizations, other groups, or at least make notice that this is something that we're starting here in the Gary Chamber. And so when I called Chris, I asked him if he could, you know, just mention what we're doing here. And so he said, what is it? I said, well, it's merely a civility campaign. In fact, when we adopted it, we called it Community Civility Counts. That's the name of the initiative.
Uh-huh.
And so Chris says, are you serious? I said, yeah. He says, look, he says, that is wonderful. He says, man, you ought to see the letters to the editor, the voices of the people, the kind of comments we get. We can't print the majority of them. He said, they're full of vile, vicious vulgarities and blah, blah. And so he said, hey, I think that's wonderful and anything we can do to help. So subsequently, the Times came on as a media partner. And it started there. And we began with the Times doing essay contests where young people could write in and describe times in which they performed a civil action towards someone, or in reverse, someone did it for them. And all of the essays were printed. In fact, we awarded a young person at the Pierogi Fest for the winning essay.
Oh.
And so it started there. Now, Dr. Bradshaw, who's the head of my public policy committee, also has a relationship with a special counsel ambassador to several African countries, Dr. Clyde Rivers. And they're part of an organization called Golden Rule International. So it's kind of amazing how all of this kind of fell into place, because Ambassador Rivers, he serves several African countries. I mean, some of the most violent African countries there are. And he was looking for some type of blueprint to be able to take to these countries. And so this just worked kind of well. So ultimately, what developed from that was, since there was so much initial enthusiasm, then we started to engage all of the local governments around here, county government, the Boys and Girls Clubs, different organizations. We had other states who were inquiring about what we were doing and how we were doing it. And it just kind of blossomed, and it just started to get legs of its own. And so after we took it to all of our local governments and universities and such, Senator Lonnie Randolph invited us to Indianapolis. He said he wanted to have a resolution there and have us present. And so when we got down there, it was actually adopted by the entire Indiana State Legislature, both the House and Senate, our Community Civility Counts initiative. Now, Ambassador Rivers, what he did was he honored Dr. Bradshaw and I first a couple of years ago at the Gerald Ford Presidential Library in Grand Rapids on this initiative with all of his constituents from different countries and states who come annually to his event. And then the next year, he actually gave us an award on Capitol Hill for the initiative. Last year, Congressman Visklosky, before a full session of Congress on C-SPAN and in front of the entire Congress, asked permission to speak from the Speaker of the House, and he acknowledged this wonderful initiative that's occurring in Northwest Indiana. And so it's just blossomed into now we're at the fourth World Civility Day. And so if you want me to exhale and give you an opportunity to speak at any point, let me know.
Well, let's take it to the point here. Now, we have certainly, I'm sure that the day is going to include a lot of very important comments, a lot of chances to talk about the serious nature of being civil in government and in just life in general here with all that's going on. But also, too, this particular year is noted by some interesting star-studded entertainment. So there's a chance to not only take a look seriously at civility, but also to celebrate it as well, too. Tell us a little bit about the entertainment that's planned, I'm sure, later in the day on World Civility Day coming up.
Well, Chris, if I could digress just a bit, our first World Civility Day, I decided to do a World Civility Day once. I said, we have an ambassador engaged. We have Africa involved. Now, ultimately, last year, we had 12, 13, 14 different countries represented for our World Civility Day. So the first one was at Majestic Star Casino, and we sold out their ballroom. The ambassador was our keynote speaker. And the next year, we decided to incorporate workshops because we had groups and individuals coming in from different states who were trying to do similar initiatives, and so they were amazed at how we were able to get traction. And so we decided to do workshops. So now it's a two-day event. We have workshops at the Indiana Welcome Center in the mornings where there are different workshops on various aspects of civility. It could be civility in the workplace, anti-bullying, civility in your friends and whatever. You know, they choose their topics, and so they discuss various aspects of civility. And after that is when we go to the Avalon in Hobart, where we have our big civility awards dinner, and that is where the ambassador typically gives civility awards to these groups and individuals and schools or youth who are practicing civility, promoting the concept, and it's a great, great event. We had Attorney General Curtis Hill was our second speaker. Last year we had a young lady by the name of Carolyn Lukensmeyer. She's from Southern California. She's written 12, 13 books on civility, so she's an expert. This year, we decided to incorporate people who could personify civility in different respects, and they are notable people. As you say, our entertainment schedule, coupled with the message that we're trying to send on civility, is outstanding. Let's begin with a gentleman by the name of Reggie Thornton. Now, I don't know if you've been watching This American Soul on BET, the story of Soul Train and Don Cornelius. Well, it's all over the news, and it's a show, it's a mini-series that comes on Tuesdays at 8. I'm not promoting them, per se, but on BET. In fact, it'll be on tomorrow. And it talks about the story of Soul Train or whatever, but little-known fact is this gentleman, Reggie Thornton, from Gary, was an original member of the Soul Train show when it originated, when it first originated on WCIU-TV, Channel 26 in Chicago.
Right.
And then he was one of the select dancers to go to Los Angeles when Don Cornelius debuted the show in Los Angeles. And so he's going to come in town, and he's going to come and talk about in a competitive environment as such as that was, because who did not want to dance on national television, how, you know, civility was important and how there was a lack of civility on certain occasions or whatever. But it just kind of gives a different perspective of an actual situation. And so we're glad to have him. We also have the saxophone player for the world-famous Ohio Players singing group. In fact, this gentleman's name is Michael Turner. Guess what? they just performed in Virginia. They performed in Dallas a couple of days ago. He's a Gary resident.
Yeah.
I actually discovered him on the Soul Train cruise last year when the band was performing along with Smokey Robinson and some others on that cruise. And they introduced the band members and introduced their saxophonist, Michael Turner, from Gary, Indiana. So he's going to come and give a perspective on civility in that industry and what it means and how it works and all of that. And we were very fortunate to get our headliner, the key person, who, if you've studied her career, had some ups and downs, had some situations, has rebounded tremendously, and is well respected in the entertainment and music industry as one of the nicest, most civil people you'd want to meet. And that's four-time Grammy-nominated and Tony Award winner Miss Melba Moore. Mm-hmm. So we're, in fact, bringing people now, in terms of what Dr. Rivers has suggested, maybe about 15 people representing various countries. And we've had people fly 30 hours to come to Northwest Indiana. And a star-studded lineup of entertainers who are going to even further express the need for civility. So we're kind of excited about what is occurring, and we appreciate the opportunity that you're giving, because we hope all of Northwest Indiana embrace the fact that this is wonderful, this is positive, and this is something that we can be at the forefront of the nation.
Well, it sounds like there are some great events, not only during the day that's going to happen at the Indiana Welcome Center in Hammond with the workshops, but also this Civility Awards Dinner that's happening in that evening. We're talking April 11th, of course, at the Avalon Manor. So there are a lot of, with all these great performers and people with very inspiring and worthy comments to hear. It's worth certainly looking into. And if anybody's interested in being a part, being an attendance to this program, how can they find out more about the program and if they need to get tickets and the like, where they should need to get them?
Our phone number is area code 219-885-7407, and people can actually register for just a workshop. They can register for just the awards dinner, but of course if they want full day participation, there's one discounted price that will enable them to partake in all of the activities. And I didn't mention too that again, we were very fortunate to have several schools, high schools, bring their kids to the workshops. And Ambassador Rivers is great in that the kids don't just come as observers. They're interactive. They get a chance to meet, greet, talk, participate with some of these people from around the world. And it's just a wonderful educational and life experience for them as well. So we just think that it has really checked all the boxes. All we need now is just for everyone in Northwest Indiana to share the pride that we have in being able to have an event and an initiative that can attract people to our beautiful area in such numbers.
Well, Chuck, it sounds like with two great events all combined together in that one day, World Civility Day, coming up on April 11th, it's certainly worth checking out for the workshops, and if they can't attend that, perhaps to take part in attending the awards dinner and the great entertainment plan for that. It's, as we said, coming up on April 11th, and there's more information available on the Gary Chamber of Commerce website. And, Chuck, we thank you very much for bringing us up to date, and we trust that this fourth, I guess what we were considering, fourth annual World Civility Day is just as much a success as the very first one.
Well, thank you for that, Chris. And I'm sorry I'm a man of few words, but
well, we appreciate you. And we appreciate you spending the time and going in great detail about this, because this is a great event that's all fit together in one very important day. And with a number of events that are going on in Northwest Indiana that is looking seriously into the question of civility, this is a great one to not only learn from during the day with the workshops at the Indiana Welcome Center, but to enjoy some great entertainment that night at the Avalon Manor. Thanks for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate that opportunity. In Northwest Indiana, let's be the greatest host there are for all these people coming in to see us. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Chuck Hughes is the Executive Director of the Gary Chamber of Commerce. The Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra, led by director and conductor Kirk Muspratt, is making available The Keys to France. It's going to be on Friday, April 5th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. in the auditorium at Living Hope Church in Merrillville. And he stopped by the Lakeshore Public Radio studios to talk about this very French concert, the featured artists, and the pieces they'll play.
This is a very exciting concert, I think. First of all, Winston Choi, who is the head of the piano department at Roosevelt downtown in Chicago, has played with us before. He's an award-winning, prize-winning pianist who can play anything, and one of the most highly regarded and sought-after pianists in the entire region, not just Chicago, but he's playing all over the world. So he's going to play the brilliant Saint-Saëns Piano Concerto No. 2. We're going to also play the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony. It's so-called the Organ Symphony because in the final movement, the huge, enormous organ comes in on top of the orchestra. And I maybe shouldn't use the word obliterates. That's not a very good artistic word, is it?
Well, in terms that's probably being accurate. You know, it overpowers everybody.
Yeah,
sure.
It's really overpowering. And we have John Scherer, who is the principal organist down at Fourth Presbyterian in Chicago, coming to play with us. And I've done this piece with another orchestra with him, and it is really hair-raising. In the middle of the program, we're going to play Bolero, which people have asked me for so many times. I just had somebody the other day, I ran into them at the gas station, and I said, how you doing? And he goes, yeah, conductor, how you doing? And he said, are you ever going to play Beethoven 5? And I told him when we might do that.
Yeah.
And it's Beethoven's 250th birthday next year. And he said, when are you going to play that Bolero piece? And so I opened my trunk, and I say, here's a brochure. We're playing Bolero on April the 5th. So, and we just hired two. There's so many solos in the piece. We just hired two amazing saxophone players to play the two sax solos in it.
Now, we know that concert is entitled The Keys to France. What is the link between France and Ravel's Bolero?
Well, Ravel's French. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Of course, make perfect sense.
But
yes.
Ravel also was very invested where he grew up in France, and his upbringing and also his heritage at some point was very interested in the Pyrenees and all of Spanish music.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, at the time he lived, there was a huge fascination with everything Hispanic at the beginning of the 20th century in France.
I guess that's why I asked the question, because people more associate that music, Bolero in particular, with the Spanish music, the way it sounds. And you don't think about the fact that the man who wrote it is really French, but he's obviously French Pyrenees.
I can't remember right now off the top of my head, but his mother or grandmother was Spanish, I believe, and he spent time in Spain. And everybody, it's sort of like one of those fascinations where, I don't know, the whole world goes crazy for Art Deco, or the whole world goes crazy for Impressionism, or the whole world goes crazy for, you know, for instance, in Italy at one point, everything that was from Asia was just an unbelievable fascination. So at this point in music history, everybody was nuts about Hispanic stuff.
Well, it makes perfect sense, to be sure. Now, also, too, we should mention that the Keys to France, which is coming up on April 5th, will be performed in the auditorium at the Living Hope Church. And tell us where Living Hope Church is for people that aren't familiar where it is.
It's almost in Crown Point, and it's in Merrifield.
Good way to describe it. Now, if anybody's interested, they'd like to have tickets for any of the concerts, there may still be some available, I'm sure. How could you get them?
Well, just call the office. I'm just looking at the exact address of Living Hope. It's 9000 Taft Street,
and
it's just north of 93rd Avenue, if that makes sense.
Oh.
You call 836-0525.
That's Kirk Muspratt with the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.